This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Unexpected Everything. Written by Morgan Matson. Performed by Bailey Carr. The elder looked across to Tamsin in the firelight. "Pay close attention when people tell you stories," he said. "At their core, every story you've ever heard comes down to two things. Someone goes on a long journey, or a stranger comes to town." Tamsin considered this as the fire crackled. "But can't it sometimes be both?" The elder looked at her for a long moment, like he was seeing something she was not. "Yes," he finally said, his voice grave. "Very occasionally, it can." C.B. McAllister, A Murder of Crows, Hightower and Jax, New York. Chapter 1. I flexed my feet in my too tight shoes and made myself stand up straight, trying to ignore the rapid-fire clicking of the cameras going off all around me. It was still really hot out, despite the fact it was getting close to 5, but I was wearing a knee-length tweed skirt and a white button-down shirt. My hair had been blown out and curled, and I was wearing pearl earrings and a light application of makeup. It was not the way I would normally have looked on a Wednesday afternoon in early June, but this was anything but an ordinary Wednesday.
"Thank you all so much for coming today,"
my father said from behind the podium that was currently in the middle of our front porch. He shuffled his papers for a second before taking a deep breath and going into his prepared speech, the one I now knew by heart since Peter Wright, his chief of staff and main strategist, had made me listen to it over and over, until I could do so with absolutely no change in my expression. Like all of this was old news to me by now, and nothing my dad was saying would catch me by surprise. For a moment, as the now familiar words started to wash over me, I just blinked at the podium. Where exactly had it come from? Did Peter travel around with spare ones in the back of his SUV?
"Regret that the people of Connecticut might have lost any of their trust in me," my dad said, snapping me back to the present moment.
I fixed my eyes on him again, hoping that my face hadn't betrayed anything other than a supportive daughter standing by her father. If it had, this story, which was already dominating the 24-hour news channels and had spilled onto the networks, would just keep getting bigger. It wasn't like I didn't understand why. Prominent congressman, one of the stars of the party, is suddenly caught up in a scandal that threatens to upend not only his career, but the next national election. The headlines practically wrote themselves. If it had been someone else, I would have looked at the round-the-clock coverage and shrugged, figuring it was to be expected. But now that it was happening here, my front yard, my porch, my father, that certainty was totally gone. My eyes drifted to the wall of reporters and photographers in front of me, the news cameras pointed toward us, the relentless sound of shutters clicking, all of it letting me know every moment was being captured. The press knew when there was blood in the water. It was evident enough by the fact that our front lawn was now packed and news trucks lined the block. They'd been here ever since the story broke, but until a few hours ago they'd been kept from getting near our house by the guard at the entrance to Stanwich Woods, the planned community we lived in Stanwich, Connecticut. Since normally this job consisted of waving in residents while reading magazines, I had a feeling whoever was working was not
thrilled that they now had to fend off national media teams. The headlines and news reports had been inescapable, all of them leading with the fact that my father had once been tapped as the vice presidential candidate before withdrawing 5 years earlier. Everyone brought up that he'd been widely considered to be a strong candidate for the VP spot again in the next national election, or even higher. Reporters commented on the story with barely concealed glee, and the segments and headlines were each worse than the last one. Rising congressman falls to earth. Congressional corruption brings party star low. Walker trips himself up. I'd been around the press practically my whole life, but it had never felt like this. My father, Representative Alexander Walker, had been a member of Congress since I was 3. He'd been a public defender before that, but I had no recollection of it, of a time when there weren't voters to count and messages to craft and districts to analyze. Some of my friends' fathers had jobs that they did and then left the office and forgot about, but that had never been my dad. His work was his life, which meant it was mine, too. It hadn't been so bad when I was a kid, but in the last few years, things had changed. I'd always been part of the Alex Walker brand, the daughter of a diligent single father who worked hard for the people of Connecticut. But now I was also a potential liability. Countless examples of politicians' kids who'd tanked, or at least threatened to damage, their parents' careers were laid out for me as cautionary tales and clear examples of what I was not supposed to do. I would not say anything offensive, or anything that could be interpreted as such, in a public forum or in earshot of the media. I would not be photographed doing or wearing anything even mildly controversial. I had the same social media accounts as everyone else, but mine were regulated by a series of interns, and I wasn't allowed to post to them without permission. I'd had a week of media training when I was 13, and after that, I'd never strayed too far from the message, from the words that were vetted and scripted and written for me. I didn't cause my dad or his team any trouble if I could help it. It wasn't like I never did anything that made waves. I'd once, without thinking, ordered my regular latte on a campaign stop, and his staff had had a 2-hour meeting about it. Then they'd had a 1-hour meeting with me, complete with an agenda labeled Alexandra, despite the fact that nobody who actually knew me ever called me by my real name. I was Andy, and had been since I was little, and couldn't quite manage the 4-syllable name my parents had landed me with. Andra was the best I could manage it too, which turned into Andy. And 15 years later, here I still was. In the end, it was decided that when there was press around, I could no longer order $5 iced sugar-free vanilla soy lattes. They didn't want me to seem like a rich kid throwing her money around while the people of Connecticut struggled to put food on the table. They also didn't want to offend the dairy lobby. It didn't seem possible that after years of being beyond careful, watching all the tiniest details, and trying never to make a mistake, we'd ended up here anyway. But not because of anything I'd done, or even anything my dad had done, according to the version of events Peter had been giving the media ever since this broke. But this was happening because someone in his office had, allegedly, taken charitable contributions that were intended for my dad's foundation and funneled them into his re-election campaign fund. Apparently, when it was discovered during an audit that my dad's foundation was nearly bankrupt, people began asking questions, which had led to this, to today, much more quickly than I could get my head around. 2 weeks ago, my life had been normal. My dad had been in D.C., working as usual. I'd been finishing up the school year, hanging out with my friends,
And planning how to break up with my boyfriend, Zach. Buy the lockers right after his graduation, quick and fast, like ripping off a band-aid. 2 weeks ago, my life had been going to plan. And now there was a podium on the porch. I let my eyes fall for just a second to a spot on the lawn where a thick cable was laid out, flattening the grass. A month ago, my dad and I had shot promo photos and ads there for his fall campaign. My dad in a jacket but no tie, me in a skirt and cashmere sweater. There had been fake fall leaves scattered over the grass, turning May into October. I hadn't asked if these had been purchased or if some intern had had to make them, because I really hadn't wanted to know the answer. We'd been shooting all day. First stills, then video. My dad and I walking across the lawn together, like this was totally normal. As if we ever got dressed up to walk across the lawn and have a chat just for fun. As we were nearing the end of the day, the director had looked at the two of us and sighed. "Don't you guys have a dog or something?" My dad had been on his BlackBerry as usual, not even hearing this, and it had fallen to me to give him a smile and say, "No dog, just the two of us." And he'd nodded and said something to the guy holding the silver disc that bounced light onto us, and we'd moved on into the next setup. Projecting the image of a small, happy family once again. Now, though, I didn't know if those mailers or ads, complete with my dad's campaign slogan, "Toward the Future," would ever be used. From where I was standing on the porch, it wasn't looking so good. "I will say again that I had no knowledge whatsoever of this misuse of funds," my dad said, snapping me back to the present moment. His voice was getting low and serious, and I could practically sense the press grow still, like they knew they were getting what they'd come for. "But the fact is, this violation of campaign finance regulations originated in my office. And since it was an office under my control and my leadership, I must take responsibility. As you know, I've asked for an independent investigation, one that can get to the bottom of how this occurred. I've directed my staff to cooperate to the fullest extent, and while the investigation is ongoing..." Here, my dad drew in a breath and rubbed his wedding ring with his thumb, his nervous tick. Apparently, he'd lost four the first year he and my mother were married. And so she'd bought him a crazy expensive one in the hope that he might hold on to it. He had, but ever since he'd been absently checking for its existence. The press sometimes commented on the fact that he was still wearing it, 5 years later. But I had a feeling today that would not be one of the questions shouted at him from our lawn. There were much bigger headline-generating fish to fry.
"While the investigation is ongoing, I will be taking a leave of absence. I feel that I cannot serve my district or my state effectively while this is being investigated. I will be donating my salary to the Ovarian Cancer Research Fund."
I hadn't heard about the charity. It wasn't in the last draft of the speech Peter read to me, and I tried not to let any surprise pass over my face. But I couldn't help wondering if it had been a last-minute addition, or if this was just something they hadn't thought I needed to know.
"I will be taking this time away from Congress to reflect on any actions that might have brought me here, and to spend time with my family."
My father glanced over at me, and I gave him the smile that Peter had made me rehearse that morning. It was supposed to be supportive, encouraging and kind, but couldn't be too happy. I had no idea if it came off or not, but all I could think as my dad turned back to the press was how strange this all was, this bizarre theater we were performing for the national press on our front porch.
"I will not be taking any questions at this time. Thank you very much for your attention.
He turned away from the podium as the reporters on our lawn started yelling questions. As we'd practiced, I walked toward my dad and he put an arm around my shoulders as someone pulled the front door open from the inside. I glanced back to see Peter stepping smoothly up to the podium, answering the shouted questions my dad had walked away from. The second we were inside, my dad dropped his arm and I took a step away. The door was firmly shut behind us by one of the interns who'd arrived with Peter last week. The intern nodded at my dad, then hustled out of the foyer, fast. Most of the interns? I never bothered to learn their names, unless they were particularly cute. Had been avoiding him since the story broke, not meeting his eye, clearly not sure how to behave. Usually they were unshakable, following his every move, trying to prove themselves invaluable, the better to get a job later. But now it was like my dad was radioactive, and just being around him might damage their future job prospects.
Thanks,
my dad said after clearing his throat.
I know that can't have been easy for you.
It was only years of practice and ingrained media training that kept me from rolling my eyes, as though my dad had ever cared about what was easy for me. It was fine. My dad nodded, and silence fell between us. I realized with a start that we were alone. No Peter, no constantly buzzing BlackBerry. I tried for a moment to remember the last time it had been just me and my dad, together in a way that hadn't been staged for the cameras, engineered to appear casual. After a moment, I realized it had probably been December, my dad and I driving together to a post-holiday charity event. He'd tried to ask me about my classes, until it became painfully clear to both of us that he had no idea what they were. We'd given up after a few minutes and listened to the news on the radio for the rest of the drive. I glanced up and saw our reflection in the hall mirror, a little startled to see us standing next to each other. I always wanted to think I looked like my mother, and I had when I was little. But I was looking more and more like my dad every year. The proof was being reflected right in front of me. We had the same freckly skin, same thick auburn hair, more brown than red, except in the light. Same thick dark brows that I was constantly having to tweeze into submission. Same blue eyes and dark eyelashes. I was even tall like him, and lanky, whereas my mother had been petite and curvy, with curly blonde hair and green eyes. I looked away from the mirror and took a step back, and when I looked up again, it was just my dad reflected back, which felt better. Not like the two of us were being forced into a frame together.
So,
my dad said, reaching into his suit jacket pocket, undoubtedly for his BlackBerry. He stopped after a second, though, and dropped his hand, when he must have remembered it wasn't there. Peter had confiscated it so that it wouldn't go off during the press conference. He'd taken my cell phone, too, which even I had to admit that was a good idea. My three best friends had a tendency to start epic text threads, and even if my phone had been on silent, its buzzing would have been distracting, and probably would have spawned a story of its own. This press conference is, like, so boring. Texting daughter can't even pay attention as Walker's career hits the skids. My dad stuck his hands in his pockets and cleared his throat again.
So, Andy, about the summer,
I won't be here, I reminded him, and even saying the words, I could feel relief flooding through me. My program starts the day after tomorrow. My dad nodded, his brow furrowed, which meant he had no idea what I was talking about, but didn't want to tell me that, just wanted to look concerned and engaged. I'd been watching him do it with opponents and voters for years, and tried not to let myself be surprised that he hadn't remembered. "The Young Scholars Program," I clarified, knowing telling him was the simplest path out of this. "It's at Johns Hopkins."
"Ah,"
my dad said, his brow clearing, and I saw he actually was remembering, not just pretending to remember while waiting for Peter to whisper something in his ear.
"Of course, that's right."
The program at Johns Hopkins was one of the best in the country, designed for high school students who were planning to be pre-med in college. My friend Toby insisted on calling it pre-pre-med-med, and the fact that I kept telling her not to only seemed to be making the name stick. You stayed on campus in the dorms, took advanced math and science classes, and got to shadow interns and residents on their hospital rotations. I'd known I wanted to be a doctor since I could remember. I had a story I told to reporters about my dad giving me a toy stethoscope for Christmas when I was 5. That actually wasn't true, but I'd said it enough now that it felt true. When I was applying to the program, I was confident I'd get in based on my grades. I did well in all my subjects, but I did great in math and science. I always had. And it didn't hurt that one of my dad's biggest supporters was Dr. Daniel Rizzoli, who was the former provost of Johns Hopkins. When he'd handed me my letter of recommendation, handwritten on heavy cream-colored paper, I'd known I was in. I'd been looking forward to it all year, but with everything that had been happening, I was practically counting down the minutes. My dad could stay here and sort things out on his own, and hopefully by the time I came back in August, things would be settled. Either way, in 2 days, this would no longer be my problem. In 48 hours, I would be gone. I would be in a dorm room in Baltimore, meeting my new roommate, Gina Flores, in person for the first time, and hoping that her tendency to never use exclamation points in any of her texts or emails was a weird quirk and not actually indicative of her personality. I would be reading over my syllabus for the millionth time and getting my books from the campus bookstore. I would hopefully have met someone cute at orientation already, halfway to my summer crush. But I would not be here, which was the most important thing.
"Are you all set with everything?"
my dad asked, and I wondered if this sounded as strange to him as it did to me, like he was reading badly written lines he hadn't fully memorized.
"I mean, do you need a ride?"
"I'm fine," I said quickly. The last thing I needed was to have my dad drive me onto campus trailed by a CNN news truck. "Palmer's driving me. It's all arranged." Palmer Alden, one of my 3 best friends, loved any opportunity for a road trip, and when she'd seen me looking into buses and car services, she'd jumped into action and started planning our route, complete with mixes and snack stops. Her boyfriend Tom was coming as well, mostly because he insisted, since there was a rumor that Hairspray was going to be our school musical next year, and he wanted to do some method research.
"Oh, good," my dad said.
Peter must have finished answering a question because suddenly the shouts of the press outside got louder. I winced slightly and took a step away from the door. "Well," I said, tipping my head toward the kitchen. My phone was in there, I was pretty sure. Not that I even really needed to check it, but I wanted this to be over. The whole day had been strange enough, and we didn't need to keep adding to it by trying to have the world's most awkward conversation. "I'm going to..."
"Right,"
my dad said, his hand reaching toward his suit jacket again, out of habit, before he caught himself halfway and dropped it.
"And I should..."
The sentence trailed off, and my dad glanced around the entryway, looking lost. I felt a sudden flash of sympathy for him. After all, my dad always had something to do. He was beyond busy, his day scheduled to the minute sometimes, always in the center of a group of staff and handlers and interns and assistants. He ran his team. He was respected and powerful and in control. And now he was standing in our foyer without his BlackBerry, while the press tore him apart just a few feet away. But even as I felt bad for him, I knew there wasn't anything I could do or say. My dad and I fixed our own problems. We took care of them ourselves, didn't share them with each other, and that was just the way it went. I gave him a quick smile, then started toward the kitchen.
Andy,
my dad said when I was nearly to the kitchen door.
I...
He looked at me for a moment before putting his hands in his pockets and dropping his gaze to the wooden floors, which seemed impervious to scratching, looking as brand new as the day I'd first seen this house, like nobody actually lived here at all.
Thank you for standing up there with me. I know it was hard, and I promise I won't ask you to do that again.
A memory flashed before me, fast, just a collection of images and feelings. Another press conference 5 years earlier. My mother, her hands on my shoulders, squeezing them tight as I tried not to flinch while the flashes went off in my eyes. The way she'd leaned down to whisper to me right before, when we were standing behind the doors of my dad's congressional offices. The synthetic hair of her wig tickling my cheek, so unlike the soft curls I used to wind around my finger whenever she would let me. "Remember," she'd said, her voice low and meant only for me.
"If things get too dramatic, what are you going to do?"
"Mom," I'd said, trying not to smile, but fighting it with every millimeter. "I'm not."
"You are," she said, straightening my dress, then my headband.
She tugged on the end of her hair and arched an eyebrow at me.
"If things are going badly and we need a distraction, just reach up and yank it off. They'll forget all about what they were asking your dad."
"Stop," I said. But I was smiling then. I couldn't help it. She leaned down closer to me, and I felt my smile falter, as I could see just how thin she was, her skin yellowing underneath the makeup she'd carefully applied. How I could see the veins in her face, the ones that we must all have, but on the rest of us they were hidden, not exposed where they shouldn't be. How the press conference had gone on longer than they'd expected. How my mother had left me to go stand with my dad when he started talking about her. It had all been about her, after all. The reason he was pulling his name from consideration for vice president, despite the fact that it was going to be him. Everyone knew that. It was supposed to be him. How hard I'd fought not to cry, standing alone. Knowing even then that if I did, that would be the story, the picture on the front page. And when it was over, how my dad had given me a hug and promised me that was that, and I'd never have to go through another one of those again.
"Really?"
I said now, my voice coming out sharper than I'd expected. My dad blinked at me, and I held his gaze for a moment. Wondering if he even remembered the last time we'd done this, or if they all blended together, just another promise he'd made that he couldn't actually keep. Because I've heard that before. I didn't want to see if he understood what I meant. I wasn't sure I could take another fake furrowed brow, not about something like this. So I just gave him a nod and headed into the kitchen. Walking twice as fast as usual, ready to put all of this far behind me, and suddenly feeling, for the very first time, that nobody gave rats the credit they deserved for abandoning the sinking ships. They were the smart ones, getting out while they still could, After all, they saw the way things were going, and they were just looking out for themselves. And so was I. Palmer.
Andy! How are you doing?
Bree.
You looked great on CNN.
Toby.
Totally great.
Did you do that thing with the curling iron? Remember the thing you promised months ago to teach me?
Bree.
Toby.
Toby.
What? I'm trying to say she looked good.
And that I would like to as well. Smiling girl, smiling girl.
Palmer.
How are you holding up?
In the safety of my own room, I looked down at my phone and felt myself really smile, for what I was certain was the first time that day. I could see Peter had been right to keep my phone away from me. It looked like these texts had started right around the time my dad's speech was wrapping up. I crossed over to my bed, phone in hand. We'd been in this house 5 years, but my room hadn't changed a whole lot since the day we'd moved in. It had been professionally decorated, but by someone who clearly didn't know they were designing for a middle schooler. It was all taupes and beiges and subtle patterns, everything matching, like a bedroom suite had just been picked whole out of a catalog. After all this time, it still sometimes felt like I was sleeping in a hotel. I had my makeup and jewelry organized on my dresser, framed pictures of my friends, and clothes folded on the chair in the corner. But aside from that, there was very little that marked this room as mine. I flopped down onto the bed, kicking my shoes off and settling back against the throw pillows, getting comfortable, since these text chains could go on for hours. I glanced down at the last text, Palmer's, and hesitated, my hand over the keypad. I leaned closer to the window that was above my bed. It was open slightly, and I could hear voices drifting up to me. I looked out and saw the press conference had wrapped up. People were wandering around the lawn, and there was no sign of either Peter or the podium. I turned my back on everything that was happening outside, hoping that maybe the next time I looked, everyone would be gone. The flattened grass, the last reminder of what had taken place there only a few hours before.
Me. I'm fine.
Palmer.
Really?
Bree.
Really?
Toby.
Skeptical face?
Me. Totally fine. The press conference was a pain, but it's my dad's issue, not mine.
Bree.
Me.
What?
Toby.
She's saying she doesn't believe you.
Palmer.
How can you tell?
Bree.
No, Toby's right. I don't, but we can discuss it later.
Me.
There's nothing to discuss.
Bree.
Yes, there is.
Toby.
And when we discuss it, why don't you also show me the curling iron thing?
Palmer.
Toby, I thought we were going to be supportive.
Toby.
I am being supportive. I even tried to drive over and be there for Andy, but the guard at the gate wouldn't let me in.
Me.
He wouldn't let you in?
Toby.
No, something about needing to be on a list, national security, I don't know.
Me.
Sorry, T. This should be back to normal as soon as all the press is gone.
Toby.
Well, I was offended. He knows me, after all. We go way back, me and Ronnie.
Palmer.
His name's Earl.
Toby.
Oh.
Palmer.
But anyway, we're going out tonight.
Me.
We are?
Bree.
We are. We voted, and it's a necessity.
Toby.
Absolutely. That's what I tried to tell Ronnie.
Palmer.
Earl.
Bree.
There's a party. We're all going. We think you need it after everything that's happened. I turned and looked out the window again at the press corps that weren't leaving nearly as quickly as I wanted them to. There were now reporters lined up in front of the house, cameras pointed at them, no doubt recapping what had just occurred. It didn't seem like I was going to be leaving unnoticed any time soon. Me. I'm not so sure that's going to happen, guys. Toby. Crying face. Palmer. No, it totally will. Bree. Don't worry. Palmer. We figured it out. Me. But the press are still all over this place. We'd need a way to get me out of here unseen. Don't know how that's possible. Toby. Andy, relax. We have a plan. I looked down at that sentence, feeling a tiny stab of nervousness. The fact that nobody would tell me what exactly this plan was had me concerned. Especially if Toby was the brains behind it. I moved a little closer to my window, still trying to keep myself out of sight, and pushed it open more. There must have been a reporter doing her recap practically right beneath me, because suddenly I could hear it crystal clear, her mic'd voice traveling straight up to me.
The last time the congressman was the focus of this much attention was 5 years ago, when, due to his wife's failing health, he withdrew his name abruptly from Governor Matthew Lachlan's unsuccessful presidential campaign, despite the fact he was seen as the front-runner for the VP slot. His wife, Molly Walker, died from ovarian cancer 6 weeks later. It's unclear what this latest upset means for the congressman's future.
I slammed the window, shutting out the reporter on the lawn, and picked up my phone again. Me. A party actually sounds great. Let's do it. Chapter 2. Okay, I heard Palmer say as the car slowed down and then turned left.
We're almost there. Andy, how you doing?
I said from where I was lying between the seats on Palmer's minivan's floor, under a blanket that seemed to be covered in equal parts dust and cat hair. I've been better. Just a little bit longer. Bree said from above me as what felt suspiciously like a foot patted my shoulder. Better safe than sorry, I heard Toby say, with the blithe assurance of someone who wasn't currently trying not to breathe through her nose. Toby, do I make a right? I heard Palmer ask as the car slowed and then stopped. To get to Ardmore? I piped up from beneath the blanket. Then sneezed twice. It's a left, then another right. How can you know that? A corner of my blanket lifted up, and there was Bree. A piece of her, at least, just wide brown eyes and sideswept bangs. You can't see anything. She's making it up, Toby said confidently as the blanket dropped again. Check your map. I yelled up through the blanket, then started to cough on the dust I'd inhaled. It's... Toby said, and there was a long pause in which she must have checked the directions on her phone. Seriously? She asked, not sounding impressed, but annoyed. Told you, I said. I hadn't been trying to track where we were going ever since we'd left my house. But there were some things you couldn't turn off. And I liked always knowing where I was and how to get where I was going. It was the reason, whenever we needed to go somewhere in separate cars, everyone always followed me.
Quick, drive around in circles to confuse her, Toby said, and I heard Bree laugh.
I don't think the party's going to be worth all this, I said as the car made, sure enough, a left and then another right. It slowed even more and started to feel like it had pulled off the pavement and onto the side of the road. It was amazing how much more you could tell about these things when you were lying on the floor. It turned out that the plan to get me to this party had been Palmer's, and I had to admire her thoroughness. Palmer lived 3 houses down from me in Stanwich Woods. She'd taken a walk after the press conference to scout things out, and had seen, even though the media was supposed to have cleared out, that there were several news vans parked in front of the Stanwich Woods gate, no doubt hoping for another scoop. So, she'd picked me up at my house, and then she'd smuggled me, hiding under the blanket, past the vans. Even though I was pretty sure we were in the clear and that nobody was tailing us, I stayed hidden as we drove to pick up Toby and Bree. Luckily, it was only one stop. It almost always was. All 4 of us were best friends, but Toby and Bree were best friends and basically inseparable. We headed to the party right after picking them up, which was good since I was nearing the limit of my endurance for being stuck under a blanket. But even though I couldn't breathe very easily, I was glad we were taking these precautions. I knew that if I were caught going to a party hours after I'd stood next to my dad, the responsible daughter in pearls, it wouldn't be good for anyone.
"Of course it'll be worth it," I heard Bree say, and a moment later someone whisked the blanket off of me and I blinked, trying not to sneeze from all the dust motes that were now floating through the van.
"Air," I said gratefully, as I took a big gulp of it and sat up, looking around, trying to see where we were parked and if there were any other cars near ours. "Are we far enough from the house?"
"Yes," Palmer said patiently, turning around to look at me from the driver's seat. Stanwich was a town of almost no crime, but a large police force, which meant that breaking up teenagers' parties on weekends was what they seemed to spend most of their time doing. And the first sign of a high school party was a ton of cars around a driveway haphazardly parked. So it was standard party etiquette to park far enough away that you would deflect any suspicion and walk. But I always parked farther than most people, not wanting to risk it. "Andy, it's fine. You don't have to worry about anything tonight but having fun. And you need some fun."
"It's true," Bree said from where she was sitting next to me. "We voted on it."
"We did," Toby agreed from the passenger seat, as she lowered the visor and flipped up the mirror lid while simultaneously pulling out her makeup bag. "We'd all learned years ago that the best way to get Toby out of the house before midnight was not to make her choose one outfit, but to let her bring options so we could vote in the car, and to let her do her hair and makeup en route. But since Palmer refused to let her do her eyes when the car was moving, I had a feeling we might be waiting here for a few more minutes.
"You voted on what, exactly?" I asked as I brushed some lint off my shoulder and fought back the urge to sneeze again.
"That we were going out tonight," Bree said.
"And we weren't letting you out of it," Toby finished as she started to apply her mascara.
"No matter what."
"Exactly," Bree said, nodding, and Toby held her hand back for a fist bump without taking her eyes off of the mirror. I shook my head, but I could feel myself smile. It was the B and T show, as Palmer and I had dubbed it. Bree and Toby had been best friends since preschool, and were such a unit people routinely mixed them up, even though they couldn't have looked less alike. Sabrina Chowdhury and Toby Hanna Mwinarczyk had come up to me my first day of 3rd grade at Stanwich Elementary, where I was sitting alone at recess, trying to understand the weird game that was being played with a big rubber ball. They hadn't played anything like that at Canfield Prep, where I'd transferred from after a poll showed that people, and the teachers' union, didn't like my dad sending his daughter to a private school. I was feeling like I'd landed in a foreign country, when suddenly there were two girls sitting on my bench, one on either side of me. They had been Bree and Toby even then, talking over each other, trying to get me to settle an argument about which member of the boy band of the moment was the cutest one. Apparently, I'd picked the right answer. Wade, the one neither of them thought was the cute one, because from that moment on, they'd been my friends. Palmer and I became friends when I'd moved down the street from her when I was 12. And when ninth grade started, she'd talked her parents into letting her switch from Stanwich Country Day to the public high school. When Palmer met Toby and Bree, they all got along right away, and from then on, it was like we'd become the unit we were always meant to be. "I appreciate it," I said, grabbing Bree's outstretched hand and pulling myself up from the floor and onto the seat next to her. I brushed some dirt off my jeans, very glad I hadn't worn anything white tonight. "But I'm telling you, I'm fine." "We don't believe you," Toby said, looking at me through the mirror as she started doing her lips. "Can I borrow that?" I asked, and Toby nodded and handed her lipstick to me. "Look," I said, leaning over Toby to get a sliver of mirror. "It has nothing to do with me. It's my dad's thing. He's going to sort it out." "But what if he doesn't?" Palmer asked, her voice gentle. "Then he'll take one of the private sector jobs he's always being offered," I said as I concentrated on getting the line of my lips even. "Or he'll lecture for a while, or go back to being a lawyer, and then he'll run again." My dad not being in politics was nearly impossible to picture. It was intrinsic to who he was. "But nothing's changed for me. I'm still going to my program, and when I get back, things will be settled." I capped the lipstick and handed it back to Toby. "We ready to go?" "Okay, type A," Toby said, as she zipped up her makeup bag. I rolled my eyes at her in the mirror before Toby flipped the visor back up. "What?" she asked, shooting me a grin. "It's from your name, that's all." "Uh-huh," I said, raising an eyebrow at her, but not disputing that it was true. "So what if I liked to be in control of things?" Someone had to be, after all. We piled out of the van, and I looked around, reorienting myself. "Whose house is this again?" Toby asked. She straightened the skirt she'd changed into on the drive. I had heard the debate about what to wear, but she'd ignored my shouted-through-the-blanket opinions, even though I knew exactly what clothes she was talking about without being able to see them. "Kevin Castillo's," I said immediately. It was the first question I'd asked when Palmer had started telling me the plan. I'd been to parties at his house before, which always made me feel a little better. In a new house, I was always looking for exits and escape routes in case they became suddenly necessary. "Which means it's going to be good," Palmer said, raising an eyebrow at me. "Remember the party he had in March?" "Vaguely," I said, starting to smile, recalling an hours-long quarters game and all of us ending up at the diner at 4 a.m., ordering plates of fries and laughing too loud. "Where's the house?" Bree asked, and I pointed down the street. "That way," I said. Palmer nodded. "Like half a mile." Toby sighed and reached down to take off her wedges, but didn't complain. All of us knew the drill. And tonight, especially, not getting caught was crucial. I'd been to only one party where it had happened. It was freshman year, and it was only the second real high school party I'd ever been to, and I was still thrilled and excited to be there. We were only there because Palmer's brother Josh, who was a senior, had been invited. He'd agreed to let us come if he could disavow all knowledge of us if anyone got mad that freshmen were there. I was drinking a beer from a red Solo cup, like an idiot. I hadn't yet learned any of the tricks I'd later need to employ at parties. When the red and blue lights streamed in through the living room window, bathing everyone in color. For a second, the entire party seemed to freeze. But then, everyone was in motion, running in 100 directions, for cars or hiding places, just trying not to get caught. The excitement of being at a senior's party had been eclipsed utterly by a wave of fear so all-encompassing I started shaking. If I were caught at a party, drinking underage, it would be very, very bad for my father. I hadn't gotten caught. I'd been yanked out of harm's way at the last moment. But that close call had been more than enough to scare me. My friends knew now that I wouldn't go to a party that looked like a target, and I had all sorts of techniques for staying under the radar once we got to the party. And even now, as we walked in a single-file line along the side of the road, I could feel myself on high alert, looking around to make sure there weren't too many cars parked along the road, nobody looking too long at us, nothing that might give us away. I didn't even want to think what it would do to the story if, on today of all days, I was caught at a party. It would be like pouring gasoline on a forest fire. We'd been walking in silence for a few moments when Toby cleared her throat. "Guys," she said, her tone grave. "At the party tonight, something has to happen. This is when the curse gets broken. Because I refuse to spend another summer without a boyfriend." "I'll be your wingwoman," Palmer volunteered immediately. "We can totally make this happen." "No," Toby said firmly. "You're fired from ever being my wingwoman again. Last time you tried, everyone asked you out, and Tom got really mad at me." Palmer opened her mouth to protest this, and I just shook my head. "Toby has a point, P." "It's not your fault you're a blonde," Bree added. I laughed as Palmer's expression turned from disgruntled to embarrassed. Palmer was beautiful, though she seemed to have absolutely no understanding of this fact. She had long, thick blonde hair that would be 4 shades lighter by the end of the summer. She was a head shorter than me and whip-thin, with the ability to eat us all under the table. And she seemed to laugh more than most people. You wanted to spend more time with Palmer the second you met her. "I'll take over wingwoman duties," I said. "What do you want me to look for? Are you still into the floppy-haired thing?" "I honestly don't care about looks," Toby said, her voice wistful. "I'll look across a room, the crowds will part, there he'll be, and I'll know." Bree, Palmer, and I exchanged looks, but nobody said anything. We each had something that was off-limits for teasing, and love was Toby's. She'd had the misfortune of growing up with a babysitter who regularly brought DVDs of romantic comedies with her whenever she sat for Toby. Toby had eaten them up, and so, from a much too young age, she was watching Julia Roberts bargain with Richard Gere and lose her heart in the process. She was watching Meg Ryan scrunch up her nose before bursting into tears, and Bridget Jones run through the snowy London streets looking for Mark Darcy. When Toby wasn't around, the three of us talked about it all the time, how this had warped her perception of romance forever. She now expected what she'd grown up seeing. That was what she thought love would be like. She expected guys to lift boomboxes outside her house and talk in declarations about what they loved best about her. And she was always, though she denied it, trying to turn Bree into her plucky sidekick. I had tried to tell her over and over that romance in real life was nothing like the movies, and that you shouldn't want it to be. That really, all you needed was a guy who was a blast to hang out with, a great kisser, someone to have fun with. None of the rest of us expected movie love. Palmer and Tom were practically married, and Bree tended to date seniors for 3 or 4 months at a time. But Toby wanted her happily ever after, her last-minute chase to the airport, her declaration of love. Which was why I was pretty sure she'd never have a real boyfriend. She approached every guy wondering if he was the end of her romantic comedy, which invariably freaked them out. "Just, maybe don't put so much pressure on it," I said, choosing my words carefully. "Maybe just have fun?" "Easy for you to say, Andy," Toby scoffed. "You always have a boyfriend." "Not at the moment," Palmer pointed out. "But most of the time," Bree jumped in, backing up Toby as usual. "Like, what, 60% of the time?" "More like 75, Toby countered. "Poor Zach," said Palmer with an exaggerated sigh. "I liked him." "We should really stop learning their names," Bree said, deadpan, and Toby grinned. "Totally," she said. "It'll make things easier. I'll just give the next one a nickname." "Funny." I tried to look at her sternly, but gave up after a minute and started to laugh. The thing was, they weren't wrong. They would tease me like this after most of my breakups, calling me a serial heartbreaker. But it wasn't intentional. It was just the way it always unfolded. First, I'd get a crush on someone. This could, in truth, last much longer than the actual dating the guy part of things. I wouldn't be able to think about anything else. I'd talk about him constantly. I'd spend way too long getting ready, just in case I saw him. Then we'd start going out. And usually the first week or so was great. Lots of making out, lots of butterflies in my stomach, lots of giddiness and hand-holding and endless conversations, either in person or on the phone late at night. But, inevitably, after the third week rolled around, he would start wanting more, and I would start getting antsy. Whether it was physical or emotional, it was always more than I felt comfortable with. I could never understand when guys wanted to talk to you about your feelings. That was what my friends were for. Why was it impossible to keep things easy? Light, fun, not too serious, and nothing more than kissing. At any rate, 3 weeks seemed to be about as long as this had ever been able to last. Whenever my friends brought it up, I pointed to my relationship with Travis Friedman, which had lasted 5 weeks and change. But I was always told this didn't count because 2 of those weeks were over winter break. But this was the way I liked things. I ended it, or he did. I had a few weeks getting over it and listening to lots of girl power music and eating ice cream. And then, before too long, I'd start to crush on someone new and would begin the whole cycle over again. It worked for me. And honestly, I'd never understood the point of getting too serious with anyone you met in high school. It was high school. Best to keep it light and date seriously in college or med school with people who were actually going to end up mattering. "Wait a sec. Why are you even scoping out prospects?" Palmer asked, turning her head to look back at Toby. "What about Wyatt?" Toby shook her head. "He's not back in town yet." "He might be," Bree said. "I saw he posted a picture yesterday that looked like downtown."
"Wait, what?"
Toby asked, as she stopped short, nearly causing a pile-up as she dug in her purse for her phone, and then frantically started scrolling through it.
"That should have been the lead item. Why didn't you guys tell me?"
"I didn't know," I said, holding up my hands and giving her a "don't blame me" face. Wyatt Miller went to boarding school in Massachusetts during the year, but his family lived here, in Stanwich, and he came back for summers. We'd met him last year when he'd been working in the beach concession stand and started giving us free fries and unlimited soda refills. We'd all started hanging out. Wyatt and my summer boyfriend Nick had gotten along really well. And it hadn't taken Toby long to develop a massive crush on him. He'd still been with his girlfriend from boarding school then, so nothing happened over